Funding for NJ Spotlight News provided by the members of the New Jersey Education Association. Making public schools great for every child. RWJ Barnabas Health. Let's be healthy together. And New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com.
Tonight on NJ Spotlight News, Iran launches over 300 missiles at Israel. All were intercepted, but will this attempted attack trigger a regional war?
I think the Biden administration is very concerned that, you know, insofar as we have the war in Israel and Gaza, we don't want it to spread across the border to Lebanon.
Plus, pro-Palestinian students at Rutgers call for a global strike this week against the university's administration.
The Rutgers administration has yet to do anything to protect us or the Muslims across all campuses.
Also, moving day. If you were on the road in either Paramus or Ridgewood yesterday, you may have witnessed one of the largest patient transport caravans in healthcare history. And looking for ways to improve the state's literacy rates, the challenges and possible solutions, all part of the latest edition of our Change Project.
It's just a combination of what works for the districts, what works for the community, and what works for individual students.
NJ Spotlight News begins right now.
From NJPBS Studios, this is NJ Spotlight News with Brianna Venosi.
Good evening, and thanks for joining us this Monday night. I'm Brianna Venosi. We begin with Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel early Sunday morning, launching more than 300 drones and ballistic missiles in an overnight airstrike. Almost all were shot down by Israel's anti-missile defense system, which is backed by the U.S. and Britain, without causing any significant damage. International leaders, including President Joe Biden, are urging Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu not to retaliate, hoping to avoid an escalated conflict and regional war. But after Israel's war cabinet met for a second time today to weigh a response, there was no immediate indication of what, if anything, the cabinet decided. Though Israel initially vowed to exact a price from Iran for the attack, which exploded the two countries' years-long shadow war out into the open. Iranian leaders say the bombing was in retaliation for a deadly Israeli airstrike 2 weeks ago on an Iranian embassy building in Syria, which killed two generals. Now, amid rising pressure, Israeli military authorities face a delicate decision: how to respond in a way that doesn't make them look weak while satisfying Western allies who are already frustrated with the way Israel has conducted its war in Gaza. For more on that, I'm joined by Michael Boyle. He's a Rutgers Camden Associate Professor of Political Science and an expert on Middle East politics. Michael Boyle, thanks so much for joining me. So we know that the U.S., the U.N., Western allies are urging Israel to exercise restraint. But what are the options for Israel's response?
So they have a couple different options. The first option would be basically to call this a victory for their defensive systems. What we know is that Iran launched around 326 ballistic missiles and drones. They were taken down by Israel itself, by the United States, and also we now know Jordan contributed, the UK contributed, and Saudi Arabia also allegedly contributed, although what evidence we have on that, I'm not really sure yet. So Arab states contributed in taking down some of the drones and ballistic missiles. So did the US, Israel, and the UK. The US is encouraging Israel essentially to say, this is the end of it. To say, you were successful, you were knocked down all of the drones and ballistic missiles, there is no substantial damage, as a result, you should absolutely do nothing. Benjamin Netanyahu is under some pressure, however, because this is the first time that Iran has fired missiles directly onto Israeli territory. So his other calculation could be, well, what kind of response is possible? He could strike directly at Iran. That would be the most kind of inflammatory response, because Iran has said that a strike back on their territory is going to merit response from them. And then we get into an escalatory spiral that's dangerous. Another possibility that he has is to hit Iranian assets in neighboring countries. For example, to attack Iranian assets in Lebanon, to attack Iranian assets in Syria. We know that he's already been doing this by attacking Iranian intelligence agents inside Syria itself, attacking the airport in Damascus, for example, to stop weapons from being smuggled. So a sort of middle approach he might have if he doesn't want to strike Iran's territory itself and doesn't want to do nothing, which is what the U.S. is encouraging, essentially call it a win, is to essentially strike Iranian assets outside of the territory that are not directly in Iran itself.
Well, and it's interesting because a lot of the talk has been around fears of if it does escalate, if there is a direct counterattack. But as you mentioned, this other option of sort of pointing to Iranian other territories there could also issue some real pushback. And so I wonder, what are the fears? Because it's all about how they respond and when, and there are several options, as you just laid out.
So there's obviously a concern about escalation here. Now, to some extent, the real calculation here is about nuclear weapons. Israel has nuclear weapons, though it doesn't admit to being a nuclear power. Iran, we know, has a kind of nascent nuclear program. What everybody's really worried about is that you hit on a ladder of escalation that gets you to the use of nuclear weapons. I still think that's not likely at this point, but it is strictly speaking possible. And so what I think is more likely you're going to see is an attempt to kind of do some kind of response, could be an intelligence response, could be an attack on assets in Lebanon and Syria, that is less than something that might encourage an Iranian missile response, which gets you into that kind of ladder of escalation. It's also possible that if this goes really south, that Iran sort of entangles the U.S. in it. So in other words, Israel strikes back at Iran, and Iran's obvious response, rather than hitting Israel, which has nuclear weapons, is to hit a U.S. airbase or to hit a U.S. ship. Sure. That's where Iran is claiming a right to self-defense. But it's also worth pointing out that Iran has kind of telegraphed in advance that it doesn't want to escalate. So in other words, it announced the drones 6-7 hours before they actually hit Israeli territory. It warned in advance 10 days that it was going to do this. It actually sent a message to the U.S. to say, look, we have to respond because this is an attack on our consulate and we want to show that we can respond, but we want to be very clear the limits to our response. And I think that explains why Israel was so successful in being able to knock down so many drones and ballistic missiles.
Yeah, and of course, there's that whole issue of proportionality when you're talking about that many ballistic missiles. What's the role, very quickly, Michael, of the U.S. here? Biden has said the U.S. won't support a counterattack, but it will continue to help Israel defend itself. What do you make of that?
We know that the United States government actually, the CENTCOM specifically, we think took down around 86 of the drones that were coming into the territory. So again, 326 drones and ballistic missiles fired at Israel. The U.S. took down 86 on its own. That's what Biden's referring to. I think the Biden administration is very concerned that, you know, insofar as we have the war in Israel and Gaza, we don't want it to spread across the border to Lebanon. We don't want Iran turning on their assets in Lebanon to fire missiles into northern Israel. And we don't want to see Iran directly involved in the war itself.
Michael Boyle is an associate professor of political science and an expert on the Middle East at Rutgers Camden. Michael, thank you as always.
Thank you.
Tensions over the crisis in the Middle East remain high on the Rutgers University New Brunswick campus, where members of the Students for Justice in Palestine and the Endowment Justice Collective today held a silent global strike, calling on students and faculty to walk out of classes in solidarity with Palestinians. It comes less than a week after a break-in at the university's Center for Islamic Life and as demands rise for Rutgers to divest from certain Israeli companies. Ted Gold reports.
Less than a week after someone vandalized the Center for Islamic Life at Rutgers, students refused to shy away from campus.
There's something truly dystopian. As a Palestinian student who stands for the justice of our people, to be expected to take exams, attend class, and go about normal when nothing about the treatment of the Rutgers administration has been normal towards us.
Students for Justice in Palestine and the Endowment Justice Collective renewed their demands for Rutgers to divest from Israel and disassociate with Tel Aviv University today. Speakers said Friday's damage to the Islamic Center was a long time coming.
After 6 months of constantly submitting reports to the administration regarding anti-Palestinian and Islamophobic incidents that happen on this campus, the Rutgers administration has yet to do anything to protect us or the Muslims across all campuses.
Some Palestinian groups are calling for a strike this week to highlight the war in Israel. The Rutgers chapter of Students for Justice in Palestine is calling for students to walk out of classes this week and asking professors not to penalize them.
Intifada. We invite you, students, faculty, staff, and administration as well as all those committed to freedom and justice, to join us during this week as we strike against classes, work, and the Rutgers administration.
I'm from Argentina, so I am from a place very far away from what's going on there, but I still think that people from Latin America should solidarize with the situation in Palestine.
I am an Afro-Latina, so if I get the chance to support anyone, I want to be an advocate.
This student, who did not want to give her name, says divesting from Israel would bring the Rutgers community closer together.
It would just bring unity. It would bring closure. A lot of Palestinians, anyone that's in the Middle East right now, they're suffering. People here, Rutgers students, they have family over there. They have family overseas that suffer every day.
We value ethical responsibility over complicity, especially within oppressive regimes, as we push for divestment from Israel and its genocide on the Palestinian people.
School President Jonathan Holloway has said Rutgers has no plans to divest. Meanwhile, students here are continuing to protest while police watch on.
We are continuing the strike, and we stand against any suppression that the Rutgers administration will force on us or any pro-Palestine ally.
Students for Justice in Palestine tell us they were discouraged from hosting today's protest by the school's administration and threatened to be held liable for any damage caused. Rutgers tells us they didn't threaten SJP. They just reminded them that they were on probation. In North Brunswick, I'm Ted Goldberg, NJ Spotlight News.
There are bombshell charges tonight against Atlantic City Mayor Marty Small and his wife. The Atlanta County Prosecutor's Office is charging the couple with physically and emotionally abusing their teenage daughter, stemming from incidents that allegedly happened in December 2023 and January of this year. According to authorities, the mayor and his wife, LaQuetta Small, who's also the superintendent of Atlantic City Public Schools, are accused of second-degree endangering the welfare of a child. The mayor was additionally charged with making terroristic threats, third-degree aggravated assault, and disorderly persons simple assault. His wife was charged with three separate accounts of disorderly persons simple assault. According to investigators, Marty Small allegedly hit his daughter in the head with a broom, knocking her unconscious. Both he and his wife are accused of punching their daughter, among other alleged abuses, during arguments. Just 2 weeks ago, Mayor Small held a press conference along with his wife and daughter, who were both present, to dispute rumors of these allegations, but they didn't take questions from reporters. The controversial debate around New Jersey's school funding formula was front and center again today at the State House, where the Assembly approved legislation that will allow districts facing aid reductions for the coming fiscal year to apply for more funding. And as senior correspondent Joanna Gagas reports, raise property taxes above the current state cap without a vote from district residents.
We're here to talk about how to avoid issues associated with what is coming out of our school funding formula.
Assemblyman Roy Freeman addressed the assembly today, asking them to vote yes on a bill that would allow some school districts that have lost significant funding in this year's school funding formula to increase their property taxes beyond the 2% cap set in 2010 during the Christie administration.
We have something in front of us that must be acted upon in very short order. Otherwise, a lot of school programming is going to get cut. A lot of people are going to get laid off, and that is why we're here, to avoid that scenario.
The bill was sponsored by Freeman, along with Assembly Education Committee Chair Pamela Lampitt and others. They acknowledge it's a short-term fix that allows districts to finalize their budgets, which are due in May, before the state's budget is set. A separate bill passed unanimously today that allows districts facing cuts to postpone their budget submissions until after the state budget is finalized. But the 2% cap issue was not as well received by Republicans.
The proposed short-term solution, it was referred to as a Band-Aid, in both cases drastically results in drastically higher local property taxes. We are not addressing or correcting the root problem.
Why isn't this state fully funding its schools? How can the State Department of Education release a list that cuts school funding like the ways that Assemblywoman Lampen talks about. How are you supposed to get on? You're supposed to then just send it to the property tax payers to do it?
What this bill will do is allow school districts to ignore the voters in their communities and increase taxes well above the 2% cap, up to, as Assemblywoman Ganimort said, up to 9.9, almost 10%. In a given year.
Assemblyman Jay Weber calls the 2% property tax cap one of the greatest accomplishments of New Jersey's legislature in the last 15 years and reminded the assembly that districts can increase above the 2% cap now, but only when taxpayers agree to it with a vote.
It blows up a deal that we made with the property taxpayers in this state.
I just want to remind my colleagues on the other side of the aisle that under the Christie administration, the school funding formula was underfunded by billions of dollars.
Democrats defended the bill and the Murphy administration's efforts to fully fund the school funding formula over the last 7 years.
This is permissive. And each one of our school districts know the fact that they don't want to raise taxes. They just want to be able to educate our children. And we're here today to be able to support our educators so that our children, our seventh graders up there, continue to be able to flourish and thrive.
Some Republicans offered their support, albeit begrudgingly.
I am actually on this bill, and I do plan on voting yes on it. As my friend and colleague, Assemblyman Fryman, knows, I'm not happy about it. I am voting yes for it because it does give back some funding to school districts that are, literally desperate at this point.
In the end, this stopgap bill passed mostly along party lines, 51 to 20. But what we heard in that room today was both parties agreeing so much more work needs to be done on this school formula to get it right next year. In Trenton, I'm Joanna Gagas, NJ Spotlight News.
In our Spotlight on Business report, a massive moving day for one North Jersey hospital took years to plan and just hours to execute. The Valley Hospital in Ridgewood completed its long-awaited move on Sunday to a new state-of-the-art facility less than 3 miles down the road in Paramus. The catch? Hospital staff didn't just have to pack up medical tools and equipment. They needed to transport more than 200 patients seamlessly and without incident. Senior correspondent Brenda Flanagan has that story.
It was an historic event, monumental event.
That's how Valley Hospital officials described moving 203 patients from their Ridgewood Hospital location to a brand new facility in Paramus yesterday. They hired 75 ambulances to transport each patient one at a time, 7 minutes per trip, an eight-hour endeavor.
We planned it so that not all patients in a unit move at once, so that everybody can get used to it. And in the move, we had not only nursing, but sometimes physicians, if it demanded, traveling with the patients.
The task took 2 years of meticulous planning to reduce the number of patients they'd need to move from Ridgewood. Valley Hospital rerouted elective surgeries. In the final hours, it covered up ER signs and diverted patients to further ease the transition. Their first patient in Paramus was admitted only a couple of hours after the doors opened here.
And there was a woman that was obviously pregnant and looking like she might be in labor. And she said, I think I'm in labor. I need to go upstairs.
3 hours later, they played this over the loudspeakers.
What's that?
Oh, that's Brahms' Lullaby. We play that every time a baby is born at Valley Hospital. And we've been doing that for about 15 to 20 years now.
Their first surgical patient arrived soon afterwards.
I'll be the first guy to have a major surgery there.
Ray Andrea told NorthJersey.com he'd driven past the new hospital often but didn't expect a visit.
The new hospital very close to our house, and believe it or not, 2 months ago, me and my wife were coming from the mall and she's looked, and my God, looks like seven-star hotel. It's all beautiful. Who do you think the first lucky man he'll want to be wheeled in?
Thank you.
He had a triple bypass, and he was just a really delightful guy to take in as our first patient.
Practice makes perfect, and the staff drilled several times to execute this move. It was originally slated for January, but then rescheduled for April on a Sunday, with good reason.
So, Paramus on Sunday, the stores are closed. And that gave us a huge benefit. The traffic wasn't as high.
The new $868 million hospital in Paramus offers 370 single-occupancy patient rooms with sofas for families and artificial intelligence tools to aid nurses.
Each room has a electronic device, and it uses artificial intelligence to detect if a patient is going to fall. We have hand washing sinks that where you go to, and it monitors all the staff that are coming in and out.
Meanwhile, the 73-year-old Ridgewood facility will get a makeover, reopening as an outpatient medical arts pavilion offering imaging and surgery. For some of the 2,000 nurses, it was tough to leave their old stations, but they helped design this new hospital. They're excited to blend new technology with old traditions. And that makes 5 new babies so far. In Paramus, I'm Brenda Flanagan, NJ Spotlight News.
Turning to Wall Street on this tax day, stocks climbed as investors shifted their focus from fallout in the Middle East to strong retail sales and earnings numbers. Here's where the markets closed. A significant number of New Jersey's elementary school students aren't reading on grade level by the fourth grade. Statewide data shows reading proficiency dropped during the pandemic and has yet to recover to 2019 levels in many school districts. That's a key marker because it correlates with future academic and professional success. And Governor Murphy this year announced a new focus on improving literacy rates through phonics-based reading strategies. But is that the best method to teach students how to read? In our fourth installment of the Change Project, NJ Spotlight News looks at the strategies being used in and outside New Jersey. Education and child welfare writer Hannah Gross joins me on the set here to share what you found. Hannah, great to talk to you. Wow, what a report. I guess I need to ask first, where do we stand? Where are our kids when it comes to literacy rates in New Jersey?
Yeah, so only about 42% of students in the third grade met or exceeded standards last year based on our state test, which isn't great. And that's been a pattern for many years now, where only about at most 50% of students are meeting standards. But if you do look at nationwide scores, New Jersey is still leading the nation.
Which is not necessarily a positive when you're talking about rates at 42%. So what are the strategies that have been used up until this point? Of course, the remote learning caused a major setback for a lot of kids, and the state has a lot of work to do to fill that gap. But what are the strategies they've been using, and what did you find is working?
Yeah, so New Jersey has about 600 school districts, and the way literacy is taught can vary from one school district to another. I think the most common approach from my reporting is balanced literacy, which is a mix kind of two different camps. So on one camp, you have phonics and more explicit instruction where you're talking about sounding out words and teaching kids directly how to read, and then kind of a mix of whole language instruction, which is focused more on making meaning, thinking about context, comprehension. You might be using pictures or the rest of a sentence to figure out what a word means.
So, Hannah, when you talk to educators, and you actually went in and visited a couple of classrooms, did they find that some approaches worked better than others?
Yeah, well, it's not exactly about how they're being taught. It's a combination of the two methods. So thinking about phonics-based instruction, phonics is important, especially in grades kindergarten through second grade when kids need that explicit instruction.
Right.
But they also do need time to practice reading on their own and learning how to read. So it's really a mix. And those two tenets can be supported by things like teacher professional development, having reading coaches to help teachers out in the classroom or reading specialists. Also screening students to understand their progress and if they might have a reading deficiency, catching that early on.
Is that happening right now, the screening process?
It is happening in some school districts, including some of the ones that I visited, but it's not required across the board right now.
What do we know about which students are either meeting or exceeding the levels of reading proficiency and which students aren't?
Yeah, so Asian students and white students have the highest rates of meeting proficiency in the state, and then Black students and Hispanic students are lower, as well as students with disabilities, English language learners, and economically disadvantaged students.
Which is interesting because you cited an example in Mississippi with an evidence-backed approach, which has been successful in a state that's not necessarily known for having rates above New Jersey when it comes to academics, and yet their students who were disadvantaged of marginalized communities were actually testing higher when it came to that.
Yeah. Mississippi is a more high poverty state than New Jersey, and they spend less per student on education than we do. But their economically disadvantaged students, their English language learners, students with disabilities are actually scoring higher than those students in New Jersey on recent nationwide tests.
So there are a lot of options because this whole project is about finding solutions, looking at what works. So it sounds like you laid out a lot of options that educators are using and can look at, yeah? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and some of the things that are happening in Mississippi and in other states are already happening here, and people are interested in bringing them into their districts. It's just a combination of what works for the districts, what works for the community, and what works for individual students.
Hannah Gross for us, and of course, you can read her full project on our website. Hannah, thanks so much.
Thanks, Bree.
And that does it for us tonight. But don't forget to download the NJ Spotlight News podcast so you can listen anytime. I'm Brianna Venosi for the entire NJ Spotlight News team. Thanks for being with us. Have a great evening. We'll see you back here tomorrow night.
NJM Insurance Group, serving the insurance needs of residents and businesses for more than 100 years. Horizon Blue Cross Blue Shield of New Jersey, an independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. New Jersey Realtors, the voice of real estate in New Jersey. More information is online at njrealtor.com and by the PSCG Foundation.